This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Herbie J. Pilato, and his new book, Dashing, Daring, and Debonair, TV's Top Male Icons from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is just out from Taylor Trade. Hello.
Hey, David.
How are you there?
I'm here. I'm using my radio voice now. So.
Are you obsessed with TV?
Am I obsessed with TV? I love television. I think that it's an untapped resource for many positive interactions, and that's why I love classic television.
The ultimate babysitter.
I guess there's so many different ways to use it, for entertainment, for babysitting, for education. I just think it's a great invention.
This book is amazing. I mean, just sitting here reading it and reading through all the different actors on the different shows. It's just amazing. And I don't know where you got these pictures from. Some of these pictures are priceless.
Thank you.
I don't know how you did it, but you've put together quite a... Number 20, Ted Bessel. I mean, just reading about him, I almost got tears in my eyes just reading about him. I didn't realize what a nice guy he was.
Super beautiful person. Just a beautiful person. You know, he had originally been assigned to do the Bewitched feature film back in 1996, and I was going to work with him as a consultant on that. And we talked on like a Friday, and we were all excited. And then on Monday, he died.
And nobody had any idea he was sick or he hadn't been sick?
No, it was like one of those aneurysm things that came on suddenly.
God, that's scary.
Very similar to what happened with John Ritter, you know.
That was really sad too, and everybody raved about him too. What a nice guy he was. And you know, you think about how quickly life can pass by. It's just gone, and you just to be able to enjoy. And such a great picture of Ted in here. I mean, it's priceless.
Yeah. And John's in there too. John, I like the one with John. I think we have him laughing with his mouth wide open.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I tried to. You know, the name of the book, obviously, Dashing, Daring, and Debonair. I wanted to choose certainly representatives of that were all of those things, and then I wanted the photos in some sense to reflect that. You know, I tried to get the most elegant photos or most dashing photos of each, and if I didn't get one that was dashing, then it was daring.
Look at Bob Newhart. I mean, Bob Newhart is 80 some years old. He's still going strong. The man is still appearing on TV. He may be on TV until he's 100.
Yeah.
How does he do it? It's like he never ages, and he just seems to have boundless energy.
Well, I think it's that calmness, tranquility about him. He doesn't, you know, strike me as someone who gets stressed out, so it's working for him, you know?
Did you actually get to meet some of these? Yeah, you've actually met some famous people.
Oh yes. I interviewed a lot of people for this particular book. I met a lot of others that I did not necessarily interview for this particular book. But yeah, across the board, met a lot of them. You know, Larry Wilcox and Ed Asner and Michael Cole. I don't know. On and on and on. If I didn't interview them, like I said, I did meet them. Met Henry Winkler at one point. There was a very nice excerpt that Closer Weekly magazine did on Henry Winkler from my book a couple weeks ago, so that was nice.
Closer magazine. I didn't not realize how nice a magazine that was. And I used to think it was some kind of a rag. When I picked the first picture, I thought it's just like the National Enquirer, but it's not.
No.
It's so wonderful. You pick it up and cover to cover, it's just very enjoyable.
It's my favorite magazine ever, and I told them that because they go right to what I care about, the classic world, and yet there's no gossip. You know, if they do mention something, they tell the truth, but with respect and dignity. And that's the way to do it, and that's the way I've tried to do it with all my books, by the way. I've never set out to do exposés, but the topics that I do address, yeah, they're complicated. You know, Elizabeth Montgomery, in my two biographies about her, she was a beautiful person, but she was also a complicated person. And I tried to tell her story with dignity in that book. So it's all the way you do it.
What made her so complicated?
Well, she, you know, had, she fluctuated with her weight. And she really wasn't as confident as she should have been.
What a talent, though.
Oh, super talent. Super talent.
I mean, those eyes alone, I mean, it was amazing to watch her. I mean, and you can't even imagine Bewitched without her.
No. No. I mean, it's Tammy Grimes, God bless her, she was the original choice for Samantha.
Oh, my God, that would have been horrible.
But, you know, if Tammy Grimes would have played Samantha, there would have been no Bewitched book, I'll tell you. There would have been no Bewitched. I don't think it would have lasted more than the first season.
And this is Montgomery always seemed like he was somewhat of a perfectionist, too.
From what I
read about her and seen, she just seemed like she might be that type of person. And that, I guess that runs rampant with, you know, more than a few stars from TV.
Well, and a few authors. I mean, I'm a perfectionist too, so it's part of an artistic thing, you know. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work well in real life, but when it comes to creative properties, a TV show or a book, it's good to be a perfectionist.
Do you have an all-time favorite TV show?
Besides Bewitched, I'd say Star Trek and The Twilight Zone and The Dick Van Dyke Show. I can't pick one. It's hard.
Yeah, well,
but those are my top.
It's funny because Bewitched is still on the air today, and it's hard when you turn it on to turn it off because it's so. And I'm one of the. I always thought Dick York was better. Now you're probably going to disagree with me on that one, but I always enjoyed Dick York more than Dick Sargent. I don't know why. Just some preference on my part.
It's interesting, you know. Of course, I cover both of them in the Dashing book. But it's interesting, when I was a kid, I preferred Dick Sargent for some reason. He seemed to be, you know, not as hard to look at because it was, you know, just not as animated. But as I grew older and as an adult, I came to understand the real talent of Dick York. I mean, he was just amazing. Talk about an actor. He had done so many incredible guest appearances in other TV shows before, which by the way, I did. So
people probably don't even realize. People thought, oh, well, that's where he got his start on Bewitched. But they don't realize he was on the Twilight Zone.
That guy was acting from when he was 12 years old in radio. It was an amazing talent. However, when, you know, he had to leave the series, and he would have preferred, by the way, to stay on the show. It wasn't his choice. He didn't really want to leave, but he became addicted to the painkillers. It was very, very, very
That's
tough.
Sad. That's very sad.
He hurt his back. But when Dick Sargent came along, you know, he had a tough job to fill.
Oh, definitely.
You know? And he did the best he could, and, you know, and I really credit Dick York. He never once said anything against Dick Sargent.
I wonder how they talked Agnes Moorehead into doing her role. It seemed like, you know, she didn't do a lot of TV.
Well, if you read my original Bewitched Forever book and Bewitched book, you'll find that out. And that is that she was in, I forget the name of the store. It was like a Macy's. I know that's not the right store. But Elizabeth Montgomery and Bill Asher had saw her and went right up to her and said, you've got to do our show. And she goes, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't. And she just felt, I'll do the pilot and it won't be any big deal. It won't sell and that'll be at the end of it. Well, of course, it did sell. and then she was kind of stuck in it, but after a time, she really loved, clearly loved playing Andorra.
How could you not? She got to do all the fun stuff.
Of course. I mean, she ate that. She ate that role up. She was incredible in that role.
I mean, how did they get? I mean, Paul Lynn and Marion Lorne and the neighbor Gladys Kravitz. I mean, they got so many wonderful actors for this show. How did they know where to find these people?
Well, you know, at the time there were all good actors, because actors came from the stage, and or they came from Broadway, and they honed their craft, and there were so many wonderful actors in those days. Not that there's not a lot today, but if you get on YouTube, you all of a sudden you're an actor. You know what I mean?
Oh, and yeah, that's... Well, what do you think about reality TV today?
Not much.
Yeah, that's how I feel. You and I are right alongside each other there. I don't watch any reality shows. I don't like them.
If it was uplifting, like when they did Real People years ago and That's Incredible years ago, that was different. But today, I'm not impressed, you know? And plus, I think that it takes away from scripted television, and it takes away from actors who are very talented and who need to be on TV, not reality.
The only reality shows I will watch are ones that touch me somehow. Such a nerve somehow, like Secret Millionaire, where they help people in a neighborhood. That stuff I love.
Yes. Or what is the one about the boss, where he, the CEO pretends to be...
Undercover Boss.
Yes, love that.
Those kind of shows, if it moves me, I'll watch it. But if I feel like it's fake, I can't watch it. I can't watch these shows that just don't feel like they're not somehow... I don't know. I just feel like I'm being used somehow. I don't know why I feel that way, but I guess it's just the way. I mean, you look at TV. TV today is so different. I mean, Walking Dead. I mean, I can hardly wait till October till Walking Dead starts up again. I am totally addicted to this show, and I can't stop watching it.
Okay, see, I don't get it, you know, because to me, and I want you to help me through this, but to me, the gore and the violence, it's become too much. And it's become... I understand that there's the characters, that everybody falls in love with the characters.
Well, that's the reason to watch the show. It isn't the gore. I don't watch it for the gore and the violence. I'm with you. I'd rather it didn't have a lot of gore and a lot of violence.
But it's because of that violence and gore every 2 seconds that people have been desensitized to it. That it's become like a regular thing. And I just don't think that's good.
Yeah, I think in some ways you're right. And I've thought about that many a time when I'm watching a show like that. And that's why I can't watch The Sopranos. That's why I can't watch Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
I mean...
First of all, The Sopranos, to me, stereotyped Italian. And I found it offensive. And I just, I just can't even believe that it was accepted. I know a lot of people think that it's cool to be Italian, but that's not the representative.
But be honest, how many shows did you watch of The Sopranos?
Well, a few, but again, the vulgarity also.
The vulgarity, definitely the vulgarity, yes.
That, look, we all swear, okay? We all stub our toe and say the F word or whatever. We all get upset and traffic. But when you're in a controlled atmosphere, like a TV show, and where you can control the dialogue, to me, it's an easy way out to say the F word.
Well, what did you think of Breaking Bad, though?
I never watched it.
Breaking Bad is probably the best thing you'll ever see on TV.
Well, see, I have heard that. But here's my theory.
I'm sure you've heard it more than once, too.
but my theory, I used to teach acting and writing, and I would tell my students, with the acting in particular, do not bring vulgar language into class. Do not bring a script with swear words or vulgarity or violent scenes. Impress me with your talent. Don't take the easy way out.
But that's not what you remember from Breaking Bad. You remember the acting from Breaking Bad. That's what
I understand that, but I think it's what they used. They used vulgarity and violence as a way to get people's attention, and I think that's wrong. I think it's unnecessary, and I think there's a better way to tell stories and get people's attention. And I think that just because it's on cable, that doesn't mean, oh, we can all swear.
Yeah, well, and I understand what you're saying. You do have a valid point, and there definitely were times where I wish they wouldn't swear so much. I definitely thought that, but the acting and the story was so tremendous on that show. I mean, it transcended anything else that might have offended me. That's how I felt.
Well, now, I'll give it a shot, but I just...
You really will watch it?
Because I respect you, David. I will give it a shot, but I had issues with that.
Yeah, and I totally understand where you're coming from. Believe me, I was brought up that language was wrong on TV. I mean, my parents were horrified if they heard language on a TV show. They didn't like it at all. They would have been exactly in agreeing with you, but, you know, without the vulgarity, you wouldn't be able to watch much on TV today at all.
Well, which I don't. So I just put my DVDs on of That Girl, and I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have a DVD of That Girl. I wish I did now. You've made me, reading your book made me want to watch That Girl more than and it's probably on MeTV now. I'm not sure. But
that Bosso was so perfect for that role. You know, I recently did a 50th anniversary tribute to all these shows that debuted in 1966 for Emmys.org, which is a television academy, and I had talked to Marlo, and I interviewed him for that piece. So if you ever want to take a look at Emmys.org, which is the television academy official website, and look up my name, you'll see all these 50th anniversary articles about all the classic shows from 1966.
Well, you really ought to be proud of this book. This really is a very interesting and fascinating book. I mean, there's Dick Van Dyke. You know, Dick Van Dyke he's one in a billion. There will never be another Dick Van Dyke.
Never. He's a god.
And
he never had to do anything after the Dick Van Dyke Show. But he, to this day, never has to do one more thing. He has made such an incredible contribution to the entertainment industry. He sings, he dances, he acts. He lights up.
He not only does that, he lights up a room. I mean, the man is so amazing, and he doesn't have an ego. I don't even think he knows what an ego is. That's who he is.
I agree.
And you can't. He couldn't be any other way. You couldn't be that good at acting that you would be that way. I mean, I've seen him on The Talk. I've seen him on other shows, and he's always the same. He's always somebody you wish you knew. Somebody you wish you had as a friend.
Yes.
Somebody who could make your life a lot brighter.
Yes. Yes. And that is what people loved about him. That is what made him a star. He was accessible that way. The thing, again, just to, you know, mention Elizabeth again, but that's how she was. She made you believe in witches because she was so likable as a person. Oh. And Dick Van Dyke, so, self-deprecating?
Yeah.
He was that. He was your friend immediately. It's like you knew him.
One of my mother's favorite TV episodes was an episode of One Step Beyond that Elizabeth Montgomery was on. And it's about, I think she falls in love with a guy, they're dancing together. I don't remember the whole plot. I just remember there's a dancing scene, and I don't even know the name of the episode, but my mother loved that episode. Absolutely loved it. But, you know, what wasn't there to love about her? And so many of these people in this book, you just love, and it just, I was watching an old episode of Chips a couple of weeks ago, and I was amazed that, I'm like, I can get to this whole episode. Because sometimes they're a little cheesy from the 70s, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't really watch Gunsmoke. Gunsmoke's too slow for me. But maybe it's because I'm used to the fast pace now. I don't know.
Yeah, I never found Gunsmoke all that great either for some reason. I think James Arness was wonderful, and I cover him in the book. But I think I was a bonanza person, but out of all those shows, The Big Valley, I think they told the stories most realistically with such quality, and I don't think Barbara Stanwyck would have settled for anything less. So I think it's because of her that I think, me personally now, that The Big Valley was really a superior Western when you come to Gunsmoke, Bonanza, and Big Valley.
Exactly.
Even though Big Valley was like a remake of Bonanza, only with a female.
But it makes you wonder, did some of these actors find TV as a come down from the movies?
Well, in those days, yeah. But today, no. Today, everything, because of DVDs right. and the melding of movies and TV shows, is different. But then, you know, it was new, and the studios felt that television was going to destroy movies. You know, they didn't understand how it could help each other. So, yes, at the time, yes. It wasn't a come-down, but it was like, if you do TV, it's not good, because that means you're not going to be a movie star, and now it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, now, I mean, even come fall, Anthony Hopkins is going to join in with a TV show.
Right.
It's like, everybody's getting in on the bandwagon, you know? It's like, as long as the script is good, and you've got so many good scripts on these TV shows now. But is it me, or why could I never get into The Good Wife?
I'll tell you why. Because I tried watching it, too. First of all, again, I'm a big advocate for cinematography. I love when a show really focuses, and you can see the clarity of the colors. I love that. But it's because these new shows, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, they're like, they always end unhappy. Even when you think there's going to be a happy ending, the last 5 minutes, they'll go, oh, and by the way, we just shot your mother. And then it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, why does it happen? Why do they do that? It's a big drag. You know, there's nothing to look forward to. And God forbid you have a happy ending. God forbid everybody ends up happy at the end. No, they don't want that.
Did you ever watch 30-something?
Yes, a little bit.
There's an episode where Gary dies. To this day, I still think about that episode when I first saw it. I had no idea it was coming. Nobody did. I mean, they kept it from everybody. And I still can, in my mind, can see that scene where they pull the drawer open and there's his dead body. That just totally...
Yeah, very much. How sweet and how happy. Who the heck wants to watch that crap? You know, and it's like the Brady Bunch when they did the Brady's in the early
90s. Oh, yeah, why bother? You know, what's
and they tried to turn it into 30-something. They called it Brady-something. That's not what the Brady Bunch was. The Brady Bunch was a happy place that you'd want to visit. And, look, I'm all for realistic portrayals. I get it. I'm all for edginess. I get it. But... Really?
You want a happy ending, Herbie. You want a happy ending.
I want a happy ending. There's too many unhappy endings in real life. I don't want to see, when I see a movie, I want to see a fake curb.
Don't ever watch Thelma and Louise, then. You can just skip that movie right here and now. Just forget about it. Same with Bonnie and Clyde, you know? Actually, they're almost the same movie.
Well, you know, it's interesting to say Bonnie and Clyde, because that's when things all changed. That movie, when they did the violence and all that, that's when everyone said, oh, yeah, okay, well, let's make them all like this now. Let's be real.
How did they get away with that? How did they get away with that violence scene at the end?
I don't know. The code changed, you know. I don't know, the movie code or whatever. There was this movie code where you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. And then all of that changed, and...
Your little tidbits about all these different stars are just amazing to read. I mean, David Hedison was almost Mike Brady? I mean, is that really true?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know. I mean, what I tried to do is, the first book I did called Glamour, Digits, and the Girl Next Door, which was like the prequel to this, there was a lot of trivia in it, and it was about the women from the 50s, 60s.
Well, the trivia is fun. You need to have the trivia in it. It makes this book even more fun.
Right, but I did include trivia in this book, but I wanted each chapter to be a more of a narrative where it wasn't so much trivia. I wanted to tell a story.
It works. It's very effective.
Thank you.
I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing. It really is effective.
Thank you.
And
I wanted the reader to pick up the book and at any point in the book, open it up and be there and not realize they didn't miss anything. Each chapter is unto itself, and yet I also tried to tie it all together.
So let's tell people before you get all these letters, and I know you're going to get letters, why didn't you include Peter Falk? Why isn't Robert Urich in here? Tell people why you didn't include some people.
Well, it's not as though I chose not to include Peter Falk, and I chose not to include Robert Urich. It's just that I couldn't include everybody. You know, the publisher, we have a limit. We have a certain number of pages. There was a certain number of photos. There was a budget. There were editorial choices that had to be made. I couldn't do a 1,000-page book on the guys of TV from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I could only do a 300-page book. And then I couldn't just do mentions of every guy that was on. I wanted to really make a narrative. And I couldn't do every guy, so I had to do a representative of that particular guy type. So I couldn't do David and Ricky Nelson, so I did Ricky, even though David was fantastic on that, on the Ozzie and Harriet show. I couldn't do all the Brady Boys, so I did, you know, Peter and Barry, who were more representative and more popular than just little Mike Lookinland.
Right.
And yet at the same time, with my three sons, I showed a picture of all four, and yet I had to focus on Don Grady, because he was the heartthrob.
Right.
You know, so I couldn't do Peter Falk because I had to do Kojak and Mannix, and those guys represented detectives. And I did Rock Hudson because he was a movie star who became a TV star.
He was also dashing, daring, and debonair, all three of them, really.
Exactly.
But not Peter Falk. You don't think of Peter Falk as dashing, daring, or debonair, do you?
Not really. Maybe daring. But not all three.
Yeah, you could probably get away with Derry.
Yes. I'm on an episode of Dr. Kildare, and of course I do. I profile Richard Chamberlain in this book too. But I saw an episode with Peter Falk. He was fantastic. He was a fantastic actor. He's a little guy, you know, and he had a disability with his glass eye, and that didn't stop him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you got talent, you got talent. Same thing with Ricardo Montalban. You know, the man, God bless him, he had a wooden leg. He was disabled. He was a Latino. He was an older actor. And none of that stops him from playing Khan in Star Trek, the show, and then in the movies.
Right.
And certainly, I mean, he was amazing. So I really pay tribute to not only the actor's talent, but their unique contribution.
I wonder how he liked doing Fantasy Island. He was so good on Fantasy Island.
I loved it.
I mean, he got to really stick it to some of the people coming to the island. really show them where they were wrong or what they were, you know. It was just amazing how subtle he was. You know, he would show up right in the middle of the fantasy, you know. There he was.
And I love that he became more magical as that show went on. In the beginning, if you recall, it was really, I mean, people would pay $50,000 and they would actually construct the set on the show. You know, that was part of what they paid the $50,000 for to get their fantasy. But as the show continued, the $50,000 was gone, and he became more mystical, and the whole show became more magical, which I liked.
I don't think it ever worked with Christopher Hewitt, though.
No, it didn't. I loved him on Mr. Belvedere, but no, it didn't. And Herb Villachez, I mean, you know, he was fantastic, too.
And now, I hate even mentioning this, but I'm hearing that they're going to recreate Fantasy Island with a woman this time now.
I have really no comment.
You probably do. You just
Well, I don't care. You know, people want to reimagine. I get that they want to update it. But don't take a character and make them something they're not just because you want to, you know, get a make it diverse or whatever. I'm all for diversity. Please, do not think that I'm not for diversity.
Oh, well, of course not.
Create a new character.
Now, you're talking about changing the show in your mind that is one way and changing it into something else. That's what bothers you. It has nothing to do with being a woman.
No. It has nothing to do with that at all. You, if you're going to do The Fugitive, then do The Fugitive.
Right. Because, and they tried it. They tried it. It didn't work.
Well, I liked it, though. I really liked what they did with that show.
Which one?
I thought it was The Fugitive. When they did The Fugitive TV show...
Oh, talking about the original. You like the remake, too?
I liked the remake. I was very impressed with it.
Tim Daly, was it?
Yes. I thought they did an amazing job. When they did... Let's think of some bad remakes on TV. Oh, you know, when they remade, God Bless Her, The Violent Woman. What?
Oh, that was a mistake. Nobody can ever replace Lindsay Wagner. Lindsay Wagner, to this day, remains one of my idols.
She is the best. She's a natural beauty. There was an incredible femininity about her. And then they tried to update it and make her... First of all, she doesn't have dark hair. Look, here's the deal. Bionic Woman, Jamie Summers, had blonde hair. That's the way it is. Don't change it. And she didn't have a bionic eye. She only had a bionic ear. Don't change the mythology.
That's right.
Don't change the mythology.
Here's one big question. Why weren't people more offended by Archie Bunker than they were?
Because, it's an interesting question. Because the character of Archie Bunker was loved and hated. There were many people in this world...
Yeah, but what was there to love about him? He was totally arrogant.
Hold on. There were people in this world who thought he was ignorant, and they could go on and address issues, and it was a show that they could address issues with through his ignorance. Unfortunately, there were also people who were like him in real life, ignorant, and who thought he was a hero. And that was the sad part of that show.
Because he was so honest about it? That made him a hero?
No, unfortunately, David, there were people ignorant like him who thought, you know, it was that Italians were bad people, that blacks were bad people, I mean, that women shouldn't be this, and they cheered him on. You got to understand that a big part of that audience were people who were ignorant, who thought of him as a hero. There was the sophisticated elite, like the writers of that show and the creator of that show, who wanted to show an ignorant person and how ignorant a person could be. But unfortunately, there were also ignorant people watching it who cheered him on.
That's
the truth of it.
Well, I think it's shocking, sort of like a Howard Stern kind of shocking, where you're like, can he really get away with saying that? Can he really be that bad toward us? Can he really dislike people that bad?
Well, Howard Stern, now we're crossing reality and fiction here, okay? Howard Stern, God bless him, you know, I think he's an incredible talent. But those kinds of shows where they set out to be, in real life, mean-spirited, and hurtful and vulgar sound like a cup of tea. When you're a character, you're a written character, that's different.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true, but I'm kind of... I was comparing the fact that they both said outrageous things to get a laugh from people.
Yeah.
I think that's what I was comparing. But, you know, some of the best things on The Family, there's one scene where... Edith has to say goodbye to Louise Jefferson. It's a magical moment. It's absolutely magical. It's so sweet and so touching. And you're like, boy, I wish all the shows could be like this.
There was a social redeeming value. I mean, as time went on, Archie, first of all, he'd always get it in the end. He'd never have a happy ending in his life, at the end of every episode. But towards the end, his character became so rich that you understood why he was ignorant. you understood why he said mean-spirited things, because he was bullied as a child by his own father, because he had ignorant parents. So that was all explained.
Yeah, they mellowed him. In Archie Bunker's place, he's much more of a mellow person.
They did mellow him, and they made him, because they had to. They had to make him accessible by mellowing him.
Well, why did he have to mellow after Edith died? You'd think it would harden him. It didn't harden him. It seemed to mellow him out.
But that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
But it makes me wonder. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm thinking about it. You know what? Why that was. I mean, you look at how great Rob Reiner was on that show. Hey, what a great foil for Archie. You know, he's the one that's going to tell Archie, you're an idiot. You know, you're just stupid. You know, in so many words, he could say that to him. And what fun that must have been for him.
Yes.
or Sally Struthers, Gloria, hitting him on the head, saying, you know, just telling him to knock it off or whatever,
yes.
You know, making him feel stupid for what he was saying.
Yes, and let me clarify, Carol O'Connor is in my book. I am praising Carol O'Connor and his performance as Archie Bunker.
None other. You could not get anybody better than he was. I mean...
No, he was a fantastic actor. Fantastic. And I want to make clear, too, that this book is about the actors who made...
But I could never... watch In the Heat of the Night. I couldn't watch him on that show. I just couldn't.
Why?
It was too different. Much, much, much too different for me.
That's why he chose that role.
Right.
He chose that role because 190,000 million degrees.
I don't think I could accept him. I don't think I could accept him as somebody else.
Oh, that's sad, David. Come on now.
It wasn't my type of show anyway. You know, I'd rather watch.
It wasn't the best show in the world, first of all. It wasn't a great show.
Yeah, but I think he just seems so out of place for me in that show. And believe me, I know he had a lot of talent. I very much am amazed by his talent on All in the Family. But, you know, I just don't think it translated all that well, like you said, In the Heat of the Night. It just didn't for me. I mean, it didn't work for me. It may work for millions of other people, but it just didn't work for me. That's all I can say. You know?
Okay.
Yeah, but TV's like that. You're going to have people that love things and people that hate things. You know, why do people watch the Kardashians? I'll never figure that out. Never be able to figure that out.
Again, no comment.
And why is it we watch these shows that, I mean, Gilligan's Island, it's such a silly show, but people can't stop watching it.
Because Gilligan's Island and a lot of the shows in the 60s and the 70s, the 50s, 60s and the 70s, which, you know, many of the actors and the actresses I profile in my books, they had a beginning, a middle, an end. Whether the story was silly or not, whatever happened within that half hour or hour show made sense within that world. Not all the characters look alike. Everybody was different. Not like today, everybody's good-looking, everybody has the same hairdo, everybody's sarcastic, and everybody rolls their eyes. All the characters are the same. Back in the day, you had your blondes, you had your brunettes, you had your skinny people, you had your heavy people, you had your tall people, you had dark-haired people, you had short-haired people, you had light-haired people, you had African-Americans, you had Italians, you had whites. Everybody looked different. Today, everybody is beautiful, the same, sarcastic, and that's it. Everybody tells a joke every 2 seconds. All the characters are the same. There's no differences. And I can't see anybody. I can't understand what anybody's saying. The lighting's dark.
What is that with the darkness on TV shows? I don't like that.
The dialogue is garbled. Everybody talks fast. And then everybody talks low. Everybody talks fast or low.
I thought it was just me getting older.
No.
But you're having trouble, too. That makes me feel so much better. You have no idea.
That's why I love watching those old shows. You turn on... Put on the DVD, the Dick Van Dyke, or like I said, that girl, call it, it's bright. You can see them. Everybody's talking. I can hear them. The camera stays on the actor to let them act. Well, Killing is, you know, a couple years ago, Mad Men. Oh, my God, it's so innovative. Innovative? What's so innovative about it? They were doing that show like they did all the other shows 90 million years ago. The camera stayed on the actors. It moved slowly. The camera gave the actors a chance to act. You could see the actors. There was a slow pace. There's nothing innovative about that. That's how they used to do things.
Right, right. You have very strong opinions about TV, and I love it. I mean, it's, and that's what makes it so TV so wonderful. Everybody has a different opinion, and it's so fascinating to hear them.
Well, I
hate, you're going to hate me for this, but I loved Mad Men. I loved every minute of Mad Men.
Hey! I did not say I hated it.
Oh no, I know. I'm just saying that I loved it. That's
of course you loved it, because it was done like they used to do TV shows. What's not to love?
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying you didn't really like it.
No, I didn't say that. I said that everybody said it was innovative. There was nothing innovative about the way they did it.
Okay.
They just did it like they used to do old shows.
So you're praising it in that fashion then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I thought you were making fun of it because it was like other shows. It was too much like other shows. That's what I thought you were saying.
But absolutely not.
I love Mad Men. But I also got very frustrated with Mad Men because the men were very, very... There wasn't one redeeming man on that whole show. They're all pretty lousy jerks, every one of them.
Mm.
I mean, I don't think there was a good guy in the whole cast.
That's not good. That's not good.
I mean, I'm talking as characters. I'm not talking as real life people.
Right. That's not good. You know. And again, there's that edginess.
And it portrays, you know, people in the advertising business as all jerks. I mean, are they all that way? I doubt it.
All I know is Darren Stevens and McMahon and Tate.
And where did they get Larry Tate? What a wonderful actor he was.
Great actor.
I mean, the comic timing, and you have to be with a show like that. Everything's got to be on time. I mean, you've got to have good acting, or it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. I mean, I never understood why they had to have Serena, though, her sister. Why that whole thing came about?
Well, it wasn't her sister; it was her cousin.
Oh, that's right. You're right. It was her cousin. You're correct.
It's, she wasn't bored with playing Samantha, but she wanted to mix things up a little bit.
Right.
And so that's when they came up with the idea for the dark-haired cousin.
I should know not to question the expert on Bewitched.
No, I don't know everything. Now, come on.
You wrote a book about it. You know pretty much everything there is to know about. You probably know how many episodes of Bewitched there were.
254.
See? And who's even left from the cast? Anybody? Just little Tabitha, I guess.
Tabitha, Diane and Aaron Murphy, twins play Tabitha, and David and Greg Mandel Lawrence, who played Adam.
I forgot about Adam.
Oh, and God bless Bernard Fox, who played Dr. Bombay. He is still with us. And Brenny Capel, who played...
Bernard Fox is still alive?
God bless him.
How old is he?
I think he's close to 90.
Wow. Oh, he was so terrific. Dr. Bombay was one of the funniest things on that show. I mean, where'd they get these names from? Who did Elizabeth Montgomery ever write any of the episodes?
No, but she had a very close watch over each story. And, you know, Bill Asher went through each script, you know, with a fine-tooth comb. So yeah, they were producers of the show. I mean, towards the end of it, more than ever.
Right. So she had approval as far as if she didn't like the episode, they would ditch it.
Oh, of course. Oh.
Well, that would make sense. She was, after all, you have to keep the star happy. And she, without her, there wouldn't even be a show. You wouldn't even. And then you watch the movie version with Nicole Kidman. Oh. No. It just doesn't.
I served as a consultant on that movie, and I think that they...
Oh, you did?
Yes, they did a noble job. They tried to do something different. They tried to do a story within a story, but it was hard, you know, it was hard. But, yeah, I mean, Nora Ephron, God bless her, she tried.
I think with the problem is we've so identified Bewitched with Samantha that it's hard to get anybody else that would even live up to that. It doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, and that's why when they do these remakes, they need to hire an unknown actor. They need to hire an unknown. Because you got to remember, Linda Carter was unknown when she played Wonder Woman when she was cast. Lindsay Wagner was unknown when she was cast as the Bionic Woman. Elizabeth Montgomery was relatively unknown. So when you cast these movie stars, remakes of these shows, people focus on the fact that they're movie stars. Do not do that. It should not be a star vehicle. The script, get the script right, and it doesn't matter who you cast. When the script is good, and the actor is good, and an unknown, if it's an unknown, then they focus on the character. But when you cast these movie stars, then it's got to be about the star, and that's wrong.
Oh, yes, definitely. I totally agree. You're right, and that happens a lot of times. The star is going to bring out something of themselves, which takes away from what they're really doing.
Now, I love Mark Wahlberg. I think he's fantastic. But should he be the $6 million man? I don't know. I don't think so.
Is he really going to be the $6 million man?
He's working on it. He's too short, and he's too old, number one. Number two. Too short, too old.
So who would you cast as the $6 million man?
Again, an unknown actor. Let me see 10 really great-looking guys who could act. And they're 62, and then I'll choose. I don't care who they are. If they can act and they look the part, I will choose the best person for that part. I would not choose, even in his prime, Brad Pitt to be the $6 million man, because it would become the Brad Pitt movie.
Is Robert Conrad really still alive?
Robert Conrad?
Yeah, he's 81 years old. I was reading last night. He's still alive.
Yeah.
He's still going strong. Amazing. You don't hear anything from him.
He got in an accident a couple years ago, I believe, and he's not well, but man, there was no one better looking when you watch Wild Wild West. You know, Robert Conrad had charisma up the wazoo, and he was just a little guy.
Yeah.
But the dude was just super charismatic.
And put him with Ross Martin. Ross Martin was very good, too.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
And you always, I remember, you know, it's funny because I don't remember seeing Ross Martin on very much other than Wild Wild West and game shows. And I can't picture him in anything else. I'm sure he did other things, but I don't remember.
Well, was there a case where he was stereotyped, you know, which happened a lot. You know, if you're, especially if you're a character actor, if you're a stud like Robert Conrad, you'll never have a problem getting work, you know. But mm-hmm. Ross was a character actor. And it was tough for him. He was stereotyped.
How long did it take you to put this book together? It had to take you quite a while. It's such a well-done book. I mean, it really is. It really, and everybody who picks it up, it's impossible to put it down. It really is, because there's so much in it.
Well, thank you very much, David. It took approximately 2 years.
2 years from the beginning to end. Is that writing all the dialogue and... writing all the I didn't mean dialogue. I mean writing the book itself.
It was research, mapping it out, you know, selecting actors, doing the interviews, getting the right pictures from the right photo agencies.
Well,
and then I think one of my biggest selling points for this book, I'm just so honored, is that Adam West wrote the foreword. Batman.
Oh, that's great.
One of the Batman.
He's amazing. He's just an amazing guy. He goes on and on and on and on. And has been in bad movies, but doesn't care.
he's just a great guy. He's a great guy. And he deserves all the attention that he's getting now on the 50th anniversary of Batman.
It's been 50 years now?
50 years.
It's hard to... And yet... I mean, Batman is still, and it's still on MeTV. I think they show it on Saturday nights. I think it's on tonight, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at some of this stuff, and Lee Merriweather was Catwoman in the movie?
Yeah.
But I didn't think she made it all that great of a Catwoman. I mean, definitely Julie Newmar. And
well, Julie Newmar was just such an incredible presence.
Yeah.
That it was hard. I mean, in Eartha Kitt, she was okay, but she wasn't Julie Newmar.
I mean, Lee Merriweather, let's face it, was very pretty. And, you know, she found her way with, you know, Time Tunnel and Barnaby Jones, and I'm sure she did other things, too. Those are the two big ones that I remember, but I'm sure, you know, and then she was on the game shows in the 70s, too. But just a fun woman, definitely fun, but I don't think she would have made a good Catwoman.
No.
But everybody, I mean, the one Catwoman everybody talks about is Michelle Pfeiffer.
Wow.
Because she's she was like the fantasy Catwoman. What if you asked a man what he would like Catwoman to look like, they would say Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer isn't going to be bad in anything. She was just, you know, amazing.
I mean, you watch her in To Kill a Sunrise. She's so gorgeous. I mean, the woman is just
beautiful.
Fun
and she was a cashier. She was a cashier at like Ralph's or something, and someone stopped her and said you should be in the movie. At least that's what I heard.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So sort of like that's where she was discovered.
Yeah. And I think that her first big role was Grease 2.
So,
and, yeah.
Who were you most excited to meet when you were doing the interviews?
I guess,
Tough question, huh?
Well, you know what? In a way, I was excited about Michael Cole, who played Link, or played Pete on the Mod Squad. Because as a kid, I grew up in like the inner city, and there used to be this junk car that me and my friend Lawrence, he was a little African American friend of mine, we used to play Mod Squad all the time. He was always Link. I was always Pete, obviously. And we could never find Julie. We never had a Julie. So the episode we were always in, Pete and Link always had to find Julie. So we used to jump in this junk car and pretend we were always looking for Julie. So that was a big part of my childhood. And that show, everybody thinks that Family was Aaron Spelling's favorite of his shows, when that's not true. The Mod Squad was Aaron Spelling's favorite of his shows. And because I think they told incredible stories. So Pete, Michael Cole is Pete to me. Well, that was a big deal talking to Michael Cole. I have a lot of respect for him.
As nice guy.
Very super nice guy.
And that's so, you know, there's so many appreciative actors out there.
He wasn't born into his position, you know, and a lot of actors who are nice were because they struggled.
What would happen with an actor and actress if they got a part and they were kind of new and weren't really good at, like, memorizing lines? What would happen? How would they do that? How would they work that out? I've always wondered about that. Because memorizing lines is not easy.
Yeah, but the way they do things today, if you miss a line, cut, do it again. I mean, stage acting is different. But in TV and film, you don't even have to know your lines. God bless Ozzie Nelson. He never knew any of his lines. He had cue cards for every episode.
Did he really?
Yeah. And it didn't matter because he was the producer and the director, and he had other things going on. But it doesn't matter today, you know, or when you're doing a movie or a TV. It doesn't matter. Yes, you have to be prepared. I'm not saying the actor shouldn't be prepared, but it's not that big a deal if you flub a line. Did you ever see a blooper reel? Nobody knows their line.
It's funny. They are funny to watch. But you think of a show like, what do they do in a show like, a classic show like The Golden Girls, when they're filming it live and somebody goofs? What do? Do they stop tape and start again, or what do they do?
Well, Sophia there, what's her name? Estelle Getty would always forget her lines. She frequently forgot her lines, so they stopped tape. And I used to work that show. I used to be, when I was a page for NBC, I used to work the audience for that show.
Really?
And I was actually one of the first publicity people who worked it and happened to meet all the actresses during the initial promotional
tour. Oh, kidding me? That must have been a treat.
It was great. And that's all explained in my book, NBC and Me, My Life as a Page in a Book.
Well, there's a book out about the whole about the whole Golden Girls, they wouldn't let me interview the author. I don't know why. I could not get an interview with that author, and I was very upset about that because it's one of my favorite shows, and I would love to talk to the guy. But he, for some reason, they wouldn't let me talk to him. But and that happens, you know. But the Golden Girls was so magical. I mean, there's just so many wonderful things about the Golden Girls. I mean, you couldn't have gotten better actresses to play those parts, you know. I don't think. I mean, just the...
No, they were great.
The interplay between them is just magical. It's something you can't reproduce. I mean, the expressions on Bea Arthur's face when her mother would do things and was just priceless. And it's a lot of it is expression. You know, you look at Samantha's expressions on Bewitched. You look at a mate, Dick Van Dyke is another one, you know. Carol Burnett, oh my God, imagine her without expressions, without her face. Oh, amazing.
She was the best. And, you know, and again, so now we're talking about Harvey Korman and Lyle Wagner and Jim Conway. They are not fully profiled in the book, because I couldn't get those three, just did not have the room, but they are mentioned. And if they're not fully profiled in my book, they are referenced or mentioned at least once. I try to. Like, I mentioned Peter Falk, and I addressed Peter Falk, but he didn't get a full chapter or even a half.
I didn't realize that Dick Van Dyke took over for Harvey Korman on the Carol Burnett Show. Why did I never realize that?
Yeah, that didn't last long, though. That was a mistake. And I think all parties concerned realized that was
a mistake. Why would that be a mistake? I mean, he was such a...
Well, because he's a top banana. He's not a second banana.
Dick
Van Dyke is a star.
Yeah.
You know, and he was replacing someone who was a second banana. It wasn't the Dick Van Dyke variety show. It was the Carol Burnett Show, and it just was wrong.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Yeah, and that's what you're probably... right about that. I didn't think of it that way, I guess. You're right, he was everything. He just takes over the scene when he's in it. I mean, you can't help it when you're that good at what you do. I mean, Julie Andrews is the same way. She takes over. I mean, she's an amazing woman. And she didn't do much with TV, did she, Julie? I mean, she did other things on TV, but not much of a TV series kind of person.
No. It wasn't her bag.
I wonder why. And you think they could have found something for her. I think, did she try one show?
She did Cinderella back in the 50s. She did the Cinderella Hallmark thing, or before Leslie Ann Warren did, and then Leslie Ann Warren remade it. But Julie Andrews, you know, was a movie star. It was different. It was a different thing. It was a different persona. You know,
and she was so good in the movies, you know, and just...
Oh, just Sound of Music is like one of my favorite movies of all time.
And she's so beautiful in that movie. I mean, you look at her and you think, "Wow, what a talent!" I mean, the voice and she's, even though she can't sing anymore, she's still working hard on those books and still having fun in her life. And you know, it had to be a heartbreak when she couldn't sing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what she loved to do. But you know, you do what you can do, and you can only do so much. You can't sing anymore, you can't sing anymore, you know? I love how you mentioned the Osmonds in this book.
I didn't believe
that. And they're all apparently very nice people.
Oh, there's a talk about talented. I saw Donnie and Marie's Christmas show a couple years ago at the Pantages, I think. And I'm going to go see him again this year at Cerritos Performing Arts Center. The best live show I've ever seen in my life.
Have you met any of them in person?
Oh, yes. I met Marie. I went to her talk show a few years back when she was on the Hallmark Channel. Just lovely.
I don't know why she doesn't do the talk anymore. I guess she's too busy.
I'm not sure.
She used to be on the talk. I used to enjoy watching her on the talk. Very opinionated, but very funny. But they're really, and she would tell really personal stories about herself, which I found fascinating for some reason.
Yeah.
She just has a way of telling a story where you can feel for her. You know, some people,
well,
when
she's,
they...
Again, she's accessible. She's a real person. You see? She's got a star quality with a real, accessible personality that makes you feel like you know them. And that's what a real star is.
That's
a star isn't someone who is... just good looking and arrogant. What good is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure there's plenty of examples of that. I don't know who they are, but personally, I've heard stories about different people. I've heard stories about June Lockhart, but I love June Lockhart. I always loved June Lockhart. It's just, you know, but I mean, everything I've ever seen her on, she's just been wonderful to watch. And but what a glorious smile she always had. And she's still going strong. She's like, I think she's close to 90 now.
Yeah. And yeah, she was actually friends with Elizabeth. They went to the same school. And there's I interviewed her for my, because she did a Bewitched episode too. I interviewed her for my Twitch Upon a Star book, and she told me a great story about Elizabeth and her father, Robert Montgomery. That book is, I'm so proud of that book. It's not a regular celebrity biography. It's not really told in chronological order. Every chapter tells its own story, but if you read the whole book all the way through, you see how the book comes together. It's a self-help book. It's an inspirational book. It's a celebrity biography book. You know, it's also my story of what it was like to meet Elizabeth.
And that's another point when you look at these 50s, 60s, and 70s shows. A lot of them had morals. A lot of them had lessons to be learned. You know, you watch the show, and you learn. These kids are learning things, which is wonderful. You know, how to treat other people, what the right thing to do, you know, and that's wonderful. That's what we should be teaching our children these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, they always seem to come, everything seemed to come out right in the end, but, you know, like you said, with all the language today, and, you know, kids have become desensitized to it, and in a way that is kind of sad. I agree with you on that. But, you know, with the Brady Bunch, everything, there was a moral to everything. There was this is the way you should act. This is, see what happens when you do something mean, something bad will happen.
Yeah.
And you teach these kids, and yeah, they were almost like the perfect family. Yeah, they had their problems, but, you know, all in all, in the end, they all loved each other.
That's right.
And as we talked about Alice before, and Alice was just an amazing, amazing person. I mean, just to listen to her snide comments a lot of times were just hysterical. I mean, she just brought so much to that show.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, you can't imagine them getting a better housekeeper. I mean, somebody you really wanted to know. Somebody, once again, somebody you would love to be friends with, sit and have lunch with. And, you know, that wasn't true of everybody on that show, but certainly of her. And the hairdos with Carol, you know, and it's all, and the music alone brings back so many memories for all these shows. What's your favorite theme song? If you had to pick one or two that were, you probably would say Bewitched.
Well...
Don't like Bewitched?
I don't know. I guess Gidget?
Gidget.
Where do you see my Gidget? I love that song. I love that song.
That's true. I mean, I love Laverne and Shirley song. I love Happy Days. I mean, there's so... Welcome Back, Carter.
Yeah, I love that. Love that.
Very catchy tune. It's hard when you hear that on the radio to turn that off. It's just catchy. And I guess that's what they wanted. They wanted to catch your attention right at the beginning of the show. And how about the St. Elsewhere theme?
Yeah, and that's another thing. Those things are missing from today's show. They don't have theme music anymore. They don't have opening credits anymore like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you had the last show that had an opening credit theme that explained the show within the theme song was The Nanny.
You know what theme song always gets to me? The Young and the Restless, believe it or not. I love that music.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't help but sit there and listen to the music. It's so pretty. I mean, it's so gorgeous. I'm not a big soap opera fan anymore because there really isn't much to watch with soap operas anymore, but other than Scandal and... Do you like any of those shows on ABC, Scandal and...
I haven't seen them.
What shows today are you really excited about?
I'm not excited about the new show. There has to be one you like. I try to get excited, and when I get into a new show, somebody either gets killed or says something so vulgar and repulsive and unappealing, or there's a million commercials now that I can't enjoy anything.
I can't.
And once I get into a scene, I'm like, all right, and then 9 million commercials happen, and then I moved on.
Well, how about a show like Bones? After 12 years, I still watch that show. I still enjoy every episode of that show. I couldn't tell you exactly why, other than the characters. I just love the characters. And there's no vulgarity on that show. It's gruesome.
Yeah, I just want shows. I enjoyed the way they used to do shows. That's all. I'm sure there's obviously a lot of talent behind and in front of the camera. I'm just not. I just don't find it attractive. That's all.
Do you think in a way television today rots people's brains?
I don't want to go there. I just let's just stay on the topic of my book and I was just throwing that out.
I just wanted to hear what you had to say, but that's okay.
I think that there's a lot of talent, a lot of talent.
Yeah, that goes. Yeah, that definitely. I agree with you there.
But I think it's misguided. I think that they think that the only way to tell a story is to show blood and be vulgar and to be edgy all the time. There's another way to tell a story. And the fast pace, the constant camera angles and jigging it, the storytelling is lost. It's lost. There's no good storytelling. And because I think that a lot of people just don't know how to tell a story anymore. Because money and marketing have taken over from writing and producing. So, with that said, thank you for having me on the show today.
It's been a lot of fun. It really has. And the beauty of it is these shows that you talk about in your book will always be there. They'll always be non-vulgar. You know, they'll always have their appeal because of the characters and the... I didn't even get to mention MASH. God, the beginning of MASH was just magical.
Oh, now that was a beautiful theme song. It was also depressing, but it was beautiful.
Don't you just love his one-liners on the first three, four
seasons? I do, and I loved it more in the first two seasons when it was funny.
Oh, my God.
I didn't like when it became... drama. I just didn't like it.
Alan Alda was brilliant, just brilliant. The way he could zing those lines, it was just hysterical. I mean, how did they write that stuff? How did they write such good stuff back then?
I don't know.
I mean, and you wonder how they do it so fast. You know, the shows are getting on the air more so quick now. You wonder how do they do it? How do they write? I have such amazing respect for writers. It's a hard job, but they do it so well a lot of times. And the book again is called Dashing, Daring, and Debonair, TV's top male icons from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Herbie J. Pilato's been talking to us. You can buy it in all your bookstores, Amazon.
BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com. You could even email me directly, and you get a personally signed copy at classictvts@gmail.com.
Now, do you have a show on now of Classic TV?
No, not yet.
So it is coming on. What will it be on? Where can we see it?
It's all in development right now.
Ah, can't say anything.
I'm a QT.
Well, you'll certainly let us know. Well, I look forward. I can't wait to hear you. I can't wait to see you. Wherever it's going to be, it'll be great.
Well, I appreciate your in-depth consideration and question, and that you actually read the book. I appreciate the time.
Well, you are welcome. It was fun to read.
I do a lot of shows and. Sometimes the hosts don't know the book or whatever. You actually do the book, and you appreciate it. And I am honored to have been on your show. And I thank you very much for the invitation.
And thank you. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.